Welcome once again to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me once again, this is our second time together. Is that accurate?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Dr. Stacy El-Khatib-Smith, pediatric sleep neurologist at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. Hello once again.
Hello. Thanks for having me again.
Thanks for being here. It's good timing because we just got started with school, you know, and then, the sleep patterns change when kids go back to school. But let's start with what are the disorders that you treat as a pediatric sleep neurologist?
In my clinic, I'll see children who are snoring, where we're evaluating for obstructive sleep apnea. I also treat children who have difficulty sleeping, so that's called insomnia, and that can be trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, maybe waking up during the night. I also treat restless leg syndrome, narcolepsy, and other disorders where children have excessive daytime sleepiness. So there are many.
Wow, you said a few things that I don't think we talked about last time, so I want to get into that, the restless leg. And when you said snoring, I guess when you say when a child is snoring, they're usually snoring by themselves. So they don't have a partner, obviously. Maybe they have a sibling in the same room. But I guess what popped into my mind when you said that is snoring an issue or something to be concerned about if it's not bothering someone else? And I have a feeling that the answer is yes.
Yeah, so snoring, not every child who snores has obstructive sleep apnea. And just as a refresher, obstructive sleep apnea is when you have multiple episodes of collapsing of your airway when you're sleeping. And so some children may just snore because they have a little resistance in the airway, but it's not enough to actually be obstructive sleep apnea. But if we do notice a child who's having snoring at least three nights a week, then we usually say, okay, maybe this could be a sign of something more. And mm-hmm. then we would want to see them in clinic. We do order a sleep study, which is an overnight study where we can check a child's breathing just to understand if it is snoring alone or if it is something more like obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay, so if you find that it is sleep apnea, what is the next step?
For younger children, the cause is often the tonsils and the adenoids. And so we'll send children to an ENT, so an ear, nose, and throat, otolaryngologist is another name of it, but a surgeon for them to look at the tonsils and adenoids to figure out if they should be surgically removed. If it's milder, there are medications we can sometimes use. And then another treatment, more in the older children, adolescents, if we don't think it's the tonsils and adenoids, then we do CPAP, which some of you may be familiar with in adults. It gives this positive pressure to keep your airway open. Mm-hmm. And that's something we can do in children and teenagers if needed as well.
Now, CPAP is the mask, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. What's the one, I can't remember the name of it, but if you see ads for something that you just have something that you stick on your chest and they say that it resolves the issue. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The hypoglossal nerve stimulator. So there are a lot of commercials about that.
Yeah.
And it's indicated in adults with significant sleep apnea where they failed CPAP. It also more recently has been indicated in children with Down syndrome if they're 13 and above. And there are a couple other criteria as well, but that's, mm-hmm. that's an option if other treatments haven't been working. But it's more in adults for the most part.
Okay. And with sleep apnea in children, I just want to clarify, sometimes removing the tonsils solves the issue? Just something that, I guess you could say simple, but no surgery is simple.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because in those younger children, especially that preschool age, early elementary school, children at that age can have enlargement of their tonsils or adenoids. And you just think of the name of it, obstructive sleep apnea. So something's obstructing is how I try to explain it to families. So if you have these tonsils or adenoids, when you're sleeping, they can get in the way of breathing, if you will. And that can be the cause, especially in those younger children. As you get older, in many people, they do get smaller. So in teenagers, some teenagers, they still could be an issue, but that's usually, then we're thinking more like CPAP as a treatment if we don't think the tonsils and adenoids are the issue anymore.
Okay, that's a sleep apnea. So when we get to the insomnia, I mean, you can have, that could be both, right? So sleep apnea can lead to the insomnia. No, I guess not. How does that work?
Yeah, so and one more thing about sleep apnea. The other just risk factor, just before I answer your question, is also weight. So if you gain weight, that can also contribute to sleep apnea because you're gaining weight in your neck as well. Mm-hmm. So that's just another risk factor for children and adults. As far as insomnia, there is a link with obstructive sleep apnea, and you know it can go both ways. You know, if you're not breathing well at night, you can have trouble sleeping, and then you know, I guess it more goes that way. If you have trouble sleeping, you know, you can just have insomnia on your own. But there is a relationship between insomnia and sleep apnea.
What do you recommend? And I know there's, you know, obviously tests that need to be done, but when you have a child come in, a parent bring their child in, and they just can't sleep, they just are not sleeping at night. They're staying awake all night. They're wide awake. What's the first step there? Because I know a lot of parents who have gone through that.
Oh, yeah. It's huge. And when a child's not sleeping, the whole family's not sleeping. Mm-hmm. And just it really sets everything upside down. There's not just one reason children don't sleep. When I see a patient in clinic, I take a very thorough history because, you know, I think of, okay, are they not sleeping first because there's some kind of medical problem like sleep apnea or restless legs, or they have this urge to move their legs before they fall asleep. You know, is there something medical we should be treating? And if there's not, then there's still many things to think about because there are different reasons children may not sleep. Common ones are, it's called a sleep onset association would be one of them. So that would be there's your child associates something with falling asleep. And so a lot of times that could be, for instance, a parent. So if a parent is there when they're falling asleep, then during the night when everyone, adults and children, have these natural mini arousals or awakenings, instead of just rolling over and falling back asleep, the child's brain says, wait a second, I need a parent to fall asleep. That's how I always fall asleep. So then they're calling for a parent, coming to the parent's bed, because that's how they've learned, you know, sleep equals a parent to be present. So that's the most common one I see. So we work on ways to help the child fall asleep independently. There are other causes. Sometimes it's more limit setting is what it's called, but it's more mm-hmm. of those curtain calls. So children with the one last thing, you know, one more sip of water, one more thing. And with that, we can do something called bedtime passes, where you give them a pass and you tell them, you know, if you ask for, you know, if you get up or get one more thing, then you hand in your pass and that's that. But if you don't ask for anything and you wake up and you still have that pass in the morning, then you can do some kind of little reward just to help motivate children to, you know, to stay in bed and keep hold on to that pass for the morning.
I think there are some parents who would say, if you hold on to that pass, I will give you $1,000.
Every reward is unique to each family. But yeah, I know. They're like, I will do anything.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that pertains to reading a good a book each night. So as you explained it, I would read books to my children when they went to sleep. And then if they woke up, they might want more book, or, you know, I don't remember exactly what was done, but you're talking about they're used to the routine. So if they're used to me reading a book to them, or a parent reading a book to a child to go to sleep, and then they wake up in the middle of the night, they want that book, or they need it.
It's a good point. I don't want to ever discourage a bedtime book, because we still say a bedtime book is great. I think it's more separating the book a little bit, so you don't want the child falling asleep while you're reading, I would say.
Oh.
Because then the last thing that they remember is, oh, you know, I need the book to fall asleep. But you reading a book is wonderful. So you want to read the book, you know, sort of close the book. It's kind of, okay, book is away. Now it's, you know, you separate a little bit, saying, okay, you know, now let's do our hug. I love you. Good night. And just, you know, just make it two separate events, even though they're part of the routine.
Dr. Schmidt says reading is bad.
No,
is that accurate? I'm just kidding. No, but that's exactly
I know, no.
That's exactly what I did. That's exactly what I did. Like they would, I would read until they fell asleep. And I think, oh God, so many parents did this. They're reading and then they turn the page and they get halfway through the page and they look up and their eyes are closed. And then you stop reading for a second to see if their eyes open. And if they don't, you quietly close the book and you sneak out. And then they're like, hey! And then you go back and you open the book. And, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yes. They still read the book. Just stuff. Yeah.
But, you know. Just do it. Just do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point is, you don't want, you try not to have them get used to the same thing every night. At the
No, that's not it. No, you want the same thing. No. You do want a routine. You want the same thing. It's more. It's more of that. You want them to be able to fall asleep on their own, and so you want that routine every night because children love routines. They know what to expect. There are no surprises. A bedtime routine is the foundation of sleeping. But what you want is when it's time for them to fall asleep, you know, you want them to be sort of in their bed with, without something to help them fall asleep. So the reading mm-hmm. is great. You know, do the book, but then you close, you know, while they're still awake,
right.
You know, then you end the book and then you say, okay, you know, then it's time to sleep. Just like with a parent, you know, parents can be there to say, okay, I love you. Good night. And then they leave the room and you say, okay, you know, now it's time to sleep. So you want mm-hmm. them to be able to self kind of soothe to actually fall asleep on their own so that when they wake up during the night, they're able to fall back asleep on their own without extra help from something. So it's more like, you know, you don't want them in the middle of something as they're falling asleep, you know, or like they fall asleep on a couch, then they wake up in their bed, you know, they say, wait a second, what's going on? You know, just same with maybe the reading. It's like, you know, you want to read every night, but you want them, you know, to not in their have that association with, oh, someone has to be in the midst of reading to me for me to fall asleep. It's if that makes sense.
Right, that makes sense. Like you did say that.
Yeah, you did say that.
You said you don't want it to happen in the middle of it, but reading is fine. But you finish reading and then you say goodnight. You want them to fall asleep by themselves, preferably without you in the room. Go to sleep. Good night. I love you. And then they fall asleep.
Yeah, exactly. Which
okay.
is, you know, easier said than done. I know
right.
every parent's groaning. They're like, yeah, right. You know, but yeah, easier said than done. But yes, in a perfect world, you know, that's what's recommended.
Simple.
Yeah.
Talking with Dr. Stacy El-Khatib-Smith, pediatric sleep neurologist at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. Let's move on to the scary stuff, the parasomnias. Like, we'll start with sleep terrors.
Yeah, sleep terrors are really frightening for families and for parents, and the child doesn't remember it the next day, so they'll be fine, but the parents are still shaken in the morning. So sleep terrors, they're part of that larger group of parasomnias, which is a medical term for these events that happen during the night. Other ones include sleepwalking, confusional arousals. With sleep terrors, what happens is they usually happen the first third of the night or the first half of the night, and they're more likely in younger children, again, those toddler preschool age, and that's because these events happen in your slow wave sleep or your deep sleep, and these younger children have more deep sleep, and they also have more of the deep sleep in the first third, first half of the night. And so what will happen is the child may wake up, they're screaming, you know, they're screaming bloody murder. You can't comfort them, you know, everyone's upset and there's nothing you can do. And then, you know, eventually they stop, they wake up the next morning, the child looks great, they're happy, nothing happened. The parents are, you know, they're saying, oh my gosh, that was the worst night ever. And that actually is what helps us, you know, it's always worse for the parent than the child. That's a sleep terror. Mm-hmm. Whereas a nightmare is worse for the child than the parent because the nightmare comes out of REM sleep dreaming. Child remembers it, you know, it'll be very frightening for them. So that's the differentiator. And, you know, having night terrors or sleep terrors, you know, every so often here or there in a preschool toddler age child is something that can be normal. But if you notice that it's happening very frequently or increasing in frequency, sometimes it can be a sign of a medical disorder like sleep apnea or restless legs, or maybe the child's not getting enough sleep. All of those things can make the sleep terrors happen more often. So that's when you should talk to your pediatrician if you notice they're happening more. And just as one other thing, it actually runs in families. And so some children are predisposed to have them because, you know, not every child has them. But if I see a patient, I often ask, oh, did parents, siblings, grandparents, anyone have them? Because we often will see that it runs in families.
Right. So that's the sleep terrors. Now, I don't know which seems scarier, the sleep terrors or the sleep walking. For a parent, that is, because the terrors, obviously, you're hearing the screaming, and that scares the heck out of you. And are you supposed to wake them up?
No, you're really supposed to just keep them safe. Yeah, try not to, because if you try to wake them up, sometimes they can become more agitated or upset. Mm-hmm. So you want to, you know, make sure they're safe, which, again, it's so hard as a parent not being able to do something to stop it. But, right, you kind of just have to support them, you know, let it kind of, go, you know, play out, and then just make sure they're safe.
Okay, now what about the sleepwalking? What causes that? Not just in children, but in adults as well. That's the strangest thing, I think, because they don't know, right? And sometimes they'll wake up or they'll be woken up by somebody, but they'll just walk around, and then next morning they don't even know about it.
Yeah, so it is. It's also a non-REM, a non-REM parasomnia like sleep terrors. So they're the same sort of, in that same category. And so, there are similarities, same thing. It will happen more in the first half of the night when you have more of that deep sleep. It's more common in younger children, again, when they have more deep sleep. Many children outgrow it by adolescence, mm-hmm. though some people still have it, and even in adults as well. The big thing there is safety, because as you brought up, people are moving, they're walking, and they really aren't aware of what's going on. They're able to do some things that are sort of in their rote memory, like they could open a door, but they won't really realize. And so, we always talk about environmental safety. So if a child or adult has sleepwalking, you want to protect the stairs. So you put up a baby gate because you don't want them falling down the stairs. Make sure the windows are secure especially for little kids, well, any age, but you want to make sure they can't climb out the window, mm-hmm. keep the front door locked, all of those things. Sometimes, you put a little bell or just something on the door so a parent's alerted if they open their door in the middle of the night.
Right.
But it's the same thing. If you're noticing it a lot, it could be a sign of an underlying medical disorder, like sleep apnea, restless legs, not getting enough sleep. So you would want to get it checked out. Other things that can make it worse are new environments. So it may be that it doesn't really happen, and then suddenly you're on vacation, which is frightening, and you're in a new place, and then it happens. So those can be triggers as well.
So you've mentioned restless leg, and we haven't gotten into it yet. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here.
Yeah.
It drives my wife crazy because I'm sitting here right now, and my leg is just moving. It's restless. But are you talking about during sleep or just in general? Because I do this, my daughter does this, but not necessarily when we're sleeping.
Right. Yeah. So that's the difference with restless legs. It has to be that the symptoms are mostly in the evenings and it's getting approaching bedtime. And so if you're someone that just has sort of the daytime, tapping your leg, tapping, that's mm-hmm. not necessarily restless legs if you have nothing at night. What it is it's this disorder where patients feel this discomfort. Sometimes they'll describe it as ants or bugs or insects crawling on their legs. Or sometimes for younger children, they're not able to, describe it. So they might just say it's pain that they have before bedtime. And it's just this discomfort. And moving your legs can help it. That's another key characteristic, is that movement helps. And then it should be worse at night than the daytime. So it's usually before bed, you have this discomfort, you need to move the legs, and it can affect your sleep. It can be really hard to fall asleep if you're having these symptoms.
Our guest is Dr. Stacy El-Khatib-Smit, pediatric sleep neurologist at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. What would you say to a parent that comes in with their child who's having trouble sleeping, and they say, well, they usually fall asleep on their, they're looking at their phone, and then if they wake up in the middle of the night, and this is for adults too, because I just read an article about, screens at night, no good. So they wake up and then, oh, well, let me just go on the phone because I'm awake. And then it wakes us up even more.
Exactly. It's a problem across the board. Children, adults, teenagers, everyone, you know, it's just such a big part of our lives. And so it's really hard to disconnect from your phone or tablet or whatever device it is. You really, adults and children, you really should turn off screens an hour before bedtime.
Right.
The screens, they emit blue light. They just hook you. You know, you're doing stuff, you're scrolling through social media. You know, they're also very stimulating. And so it's not just sort of the screens themselves. It's the fact that it has your brain going, you're interacting, you're alert, you're doing all these things. And so you, like I said, you do want to try to turn those off an hour before bedtime. And also when you wake up during the night, not look at it, because it's a similar thing. You know, it gets your brain going instead of trying to fall back asleep.
Yeah, so back to school has begun. We're about a month and a half in, and there's a change in routine when we go back to school. So a lot of parents listening right now who have young children may be having sleep issues because of the change in routine.
Yeah, it is really rough transitioning from summer, where you might not have as strict of a schedule, to school, especially for teenagers whose bodies may want to go to bed later, wake up later, and then they have these early school start times. So it can be really challenging. You know, the big thing across the board is consistency. You know, your brain likes boring. You know, they like boring. It likes consistent. So you want to try your best to have a similar bedtime each night, a similar wake-up time. And then when you get to the weekend, again, easier said than done, but not have it too different from the weekdays. So I'd say, you know, again, if you can have a bedtime, maybe, you know, an hour or so, you know, no more than an hour different from the weekdays. And on the weekend, same thing, trying to get up, you know, in an hour or two of when the kids do during the week, because there is something called social jet lag. And what happens is, you know, you've got the schedule on the weekdays. It gets to be the weekend. Everyone stays up late. They sleep in late. And then you get to Sunday night and suddenly your brain is on a totally different schedule. And it's really hard to then flip back to that school schedule. You know, it takes a couple of days. So now you're midway through the school week. Finally, you're feeling better for a day or two, or the work week, you know, and then it just starts again. And so it's really just consistency as best as you can.
Yeah, that makes for some bad Mondays.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
How much sleep should a child get? And I guess it varies by age.
Yeah, you're right that it varies by ages. So, you know, obviously when you have the newborns, infants, you know, they're on and off sleep all the time. With toddlers, they should have around 11 to 14 hours per day. So that includes naps and nighttime sleep. The preschoolers, 3 to 5 years old, should have around 10 to 13 hours. Again, that includes naps. And then for school age, so about 6 to 12, 13 would be around 9 to 11 hours. And then the teenagers would be 8 to 10 hours. And, you know, for those teenagers especially, there's so many demands. And so, you know, it's so hard for them to even get that 8 hours. But you really have to try at least 8 hours a night.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to do because they're up late studying, and it's either don't study or get... But. I mean, obviously, there's going to be nights when they don't get 8 to 10 hours from time to time.
Right.
But the idea is to try and make it consistent.
Exactly. Exactly.
For more information, go to jfkmc.org. For a podcast of this show, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and thank you to Dr. Stacey El-Khatib-Smith, pediatric sleep neurologist at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. Thank you, Dr. Smith.
Thank you so much for having me.